The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says alcohol is to blame for the deaths of 88,000 people annually, shortening the average life of those affected by about 30 years. Other studies show that since 2000, deaths linked to alcohol are up 35% to 50%.
Closer to home, an analysis this spring showed that 7 of the 10 drunkest cities in America, including the top 4, are here in Wisconsin.
A 2014 federal government study says stricter alcohol policies led to a decrease in binge drinking. But USA Today recently reported that legislative approaches don't always work.
David Jernigan is a professor in the Department of Health Law, Policy, and Management at Boston University's School of Public Health. He specializes in alcohol policy. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, we heard some of the statistics there. How big a public health problem do you see alcohol consumption being?
Depending on how you count it, it's the third or fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. It is the number one drug still among young people. It's, you know, somewhere around 4,300 deaths among kids every year. It's really both our most significant public health problem that gets the least attention.
Why does it get the least attention?
Well, you know, we love alcohol. So many people like to drink, and in particular, so many people who are engaged in our political process like to drink. Alcohol consumption in this country, as well as worldwide, rises with income. And so the people writing the laws, this is the favored drug. Then alcohol companies, this is a $1.4 trillion industry worldwide, and the alcohol industry, as, you know, industries that large will do, spends an enormous amount of financial and other capital influencing legislatures, trying to push back regulation on alcohol and keep the most effective things that we could do in terms of prevention from happening.
Before we get into specific policy measures, is it possible to have somewhat of an alcohol-positive culture, the idea that it's okay to drink alcohol and, as the phrase goes, drink responsibly while still preventing the damage, the health damage, the accidents, the car crashes, and more that comes along with a heavy alcohol consumption?
It is absolutely possible. Take a country like France. In 1991, the French health minister declared alcohol to be their number one public health problem. They have reduced consumption across their population over the last 30 years by over 25%. They did some things like put in really, really strict restrictions on alcohol advertising, did things to discourage production of so much wine, and, you know, things have gotten better. It's a balance that has to be struck, and you know, we're doing a better job in certain ways on tobacco these days than they are with alcohol. We never went the prohibition route with tobacco, and yet we've figured out how to keep it much better out of the hands of young people. We could learn a lot for alcohol from what we're doing with tobacco.
Talking to David Jernigan from the Boston University School of Public Health about alcohol as a public health problem. David, let's look at some of the different strategies. You mentioned cigarettes. Taxes on cigarettes were part of the story. Have we seen increases in alcohol taxes with the intent of lowering consumption? Are they effective?
Generally, we see the opposite happening with alcohol taxes. In the big tax cut that was passed at the federal level last year, there was an 18% cut for alcohol taxes at the federal level. Out in Wisconsin, where you all are, you have some of the lowest alcohol taxes in the country. The effect of this is a very bad message to young people because the drop in the taxes has made alcohol price competitive or cheaper than other kinds of liquid like milk, water, juice, and soda pop. We do have some examples of increasing the alcohol tax, and we've studied what happened to consequences. In Maryland, where I've just moved from, we added a 3% sales tax on alcohol in 2011, and we've done the careful studies. We found a small but significant drop in consumption. We also found a really significant drop in sexually transmitted diseases, and about a 6% drop in alcohol-impaired motorists on Maryland's roadways.
We put a question out to our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Logan says, ban advertisement of alcohol and pharmaceutical substances. We'll leave the pharmaceuticals aside. What is the impact of marketing, David, and do restrictions on marketing of alcohol work?
So we've got at least 25 studies that have followed groups of kids over time, measured their exposure to alcohol marketing and their drinking behavior at the outset and along the way. All those studies have found that the more that kids are exposed, at least, the more likely they are to start drinking. They're even more likely to progress from experimentation to more risky forms of drinking. So the evidence is pretty clear and substantial that alcohol marketing makes a difference in terms of kids' alcohol consumption. It's very difficult to do much at the national level to restrict alcohol marketing because of our strong protections for commercial speech under the First Amendment. That said, there are things that cities and states can do, particularly around reducing outdoor advertising, restricting retail advertising, just lots of things that, again, have been done in tobacco and could be done in alcohol. We suspect that they would, based on the research, that they would have similar good effects if we could do some of them in alcohol.
Are there communities in the United States that have tried banning that kind of advertising?
There are communities that have reduced it substantially. California passed a law at the state level restricting signage of any kind on the outside of a store to 30% of the windows, and local cities can adopt something stricter. So a number of cities have adopted something stricter, 10%, 15%. What it kind of does is clean up whole neighborhoods almost overnight that are just literally plastered with signage for alcohol. The studies show that the more that kids grow up in neighborhoods like that, the more likely they are to start drinking at an underage, and also the more likely they are to say that the neighborhood they live in are unsafe, even after we control for all sorts of other neighborhood factors.
We heard from Chris on Facebook. Chris says, this is what makes me nuts about Wisconsin's liquor law. I can't go into a store and buy it from 9 p.m. until 8 a.m., but I can go into a bar and consume it outside of those hours and hope not to get caught. This makes no sense except to the Tavern League. Chris says, let's talk about access. There's a lot of places to buy alcohol in a state like Wisconsin, I'll say. Does reducing access work to prevent problem drinking?
Absolutely. In fact, the Centers for Disease Control, the Community Guide, which is the big scientific body that advises CDC, when they looked at hours and days of sale, they found that any change 2 hours or more in any direction would have predictable effects on both alcohol consumption and alcohol problems. So that's hours and days of sale. Then the number of places, and this is particularly important in terms of the number of places that are selling for takeaway, for what we call off-premises consumption. We did a study in Baltimore City, found that for every additional outlet that was added to a census block group, you got 4% more violent crime. Now, on-premise outlets, bars and restaurants, they're important as well, but there's more supervision of the drinking in a bar or restaurant than there often is when people take it home, when they're drinking outside, whatever. So there's still a relationship there, but it's only about a 3% increase in violent crime if you add one of those outlets.
We're talking about efforts to fix America's deadly drinking problem with David Jernigan, professor in the Department of Health Law, Policy and Management at Boston University's School of Public Health. He specializes in alcohol policy.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to happen to fix America's alcohol problem? Is there a particular policy that you think would be successful? And how do you feel about raising taxes on alcohol, restricting sales, or improving access to treatment? That's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll pick up the conversation and hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. We're talking about America's drinking problem and some of the legislative approaches to fixing it. David Jernigan is our guest. He is a professor in the Department of Health Law, Policy, and Management at Boston University School of Public Health, who specializes in alcohol policy.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see done to combat alcohol abuse? How do you feel about the idea of higher alcohol taxes or limits on when and where you can get alcohol? What would you like to see in your community, in your state? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi, what do you think?
I'd like to see two things done. I'd like to see more ER doctors reporting it to the primary doctors, and the insurance companies paying for alcohol rehabilitation, and I'd like to see judges giving you more alcohol rehab in jails.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. A lot there. David, first of all, are ERs reporting all the alcohol-related cases coming into them and sharing them with primary care doctors, as she mentioned?
No, it's, you know, the data that we get out of the ERs is almost certainly an undercount. I've spent any number of weekends in ERs doing alcohol research. Alcohol puts a tremendous burden on the emergency room. If we could do a better job of collecting data there, it would add to the case for us needing to do more there. That said, the studies that have been done of alcohol in the ER found a significant increase over the last 6 to 8 years. People are not necessarily drinking more across the population, but there's a certain segment of the population that is drinking more and drinking in risky ways. In particular, women and young women seem to be catching up to men. This is a big concern because alcohol affects males and females differently. And a woman drinking at the same level as a man will have worse consequences.
And Mary Kay mentioned she'd like to see insurance companies and the court system do more to provide treatment for people dealing with a problem drinking. Do we have enough of that kind of treatment?
We don't have enough alcohol treatment resources. We could certainly do a better job there. And absolutely, treatment of all kinds behind bars is a big problem in this country. But that said, we will never treat our way out of this problem, and that's because the bulk of alcohol problems are not caused by people who would ever show up for treatment. The risk behavior with alcohol is drinking too much on a single occasion. We call that binge drinking. Surveys have found 92% of binge drinkers will never qualify for an alcohol dependence diagnosis. There are just so many more people who drink too much occasionally than the folks who are addicted. If we don't take population-level steps like increasing the price through taxation, like reducing the numbers of places and the hours and days in which people can get it, and like tackling the now ubiquitous, you know, advertising and marketing of alcohol, we're not going to make the progress that we need to make.
Back to our callers now. Eric is with us in Madison. Eric, hi.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call. I wondered if your guest might comment on the ways that we as a society might nip this in the bud, if you will, in terms of maybe rethinking our legal drinking age to kind of take the stigma and the appeal out of it and make it more of a mainstream thing where kids maybe experience alcohol at an earlier age in better circumstance, like their parents' dining room, for example, and then maybe they don't have such a rush to go out when they get.
Eric, we lost there, but I think we got the point. Lower the drinking age, bring kids into it more gradually, I think. And I've heard this argument from others, David. What do you think of that?
Yeah. A lot of people think that this is the way to solve things. Unfortunately, the research just doesn't support that. In fact, our drinking age is so much more protective of our young people than European countries that have lower drinking ages. We have the same surveys that are asked in the same setting with the same population, 15 and 16-year-old kids in schools, in the U.S. and more than 30 European countries. When we ask them about drinking, our 10th graders are second from the bottom in terms of how likely they are to be drinking. compared to the other European countries. The only one lower than us is Iceland, which has a drinking age of 20. So 21 absolutely saves lives. There's been so much research on this. And in fact, what is in the popular mind about this, that if we just integrate it into the household and, you know, let our kids drink in high school. In fact, the kids who have trouble in college drinking are generally not the ones who didn't drink in high school. They're the ones who started drinking in high school. We know this because we have long-term studies that have followed kids from high school through college, and we can show that trajectory. So I wish it were that simple. But in fact, we've done the opposite. We've let 21 sort of hang out there as the only significant thing that we're doing, or the main significant thing that we're doing around drinking. And we should be supporting 21 with other effective policies like higher taxes, restrictions on availability, and doing something about the advertising.
Eric, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Sarah with us in Green Bay. Sarah, hi.
Hi, thank you for such an important program today. I appreciate especially the information you shared about marketing, including marketing to young people and children. One thing that I would like to recommend people consider is, you know, really to take a stand in our communities when it comes to public advertising of alcohol. For example, a lot of the area runs in this part of Wisconsin do encourage family participation and have running programs at our local schools. My family and I participate in many of these, and one of the runs in our area is sponsored by a major alcohol company and serves both alcohol and root beer to all the participants after the race in alcohol cups. I contacted the race organizers and urged them to stop, you know, being sponsored by an alcohol company. They didn't feel they were able to do that, but they did agree to stop serving the root beer in alcohol cups to the kids who participated in the run. So it's very normalized in our communities that alcohol will be a part of these events, and I think each of us needs to really step back, see how we can make an impact and say we're not going to stand for that.
Sarah, thanks for the call. David, what do you think about Sarah's story?
You know, it's a story that could be told over and over again in community after community in the U.S. I really salute people like Sarah who are raising their voices around this. So much and so much of the country, we have gotten the situation around alcohol that we have permitted to happen. The regulations on alcohol are steadily being chipped away at the same time that the marketing is entering almost every imaginable area of our lives and our children's lives. The Truth in Advertising group has just, you know, taken on Ciroc and P. Diddy because now they're using influencers in social media, and there's not even any credit being given, not even the advertising, the payment to these people isn't being exposed. That's a form of deceptive advertising to kids, and influencers are so important. Point being, yes, this stuff is so many places. The good side of that is that there are a lot of opportunities for people in local communities to learn more about this, to raise their voices, and to ask, why is this happening, and is this what we want our communities to look like?
Thanks for that call, Sarah. Brandy on Facebook says, Wisconsin has an alcohol problem. As with anything that's fun, there's a balance. You can't demonize it or people will rebel, but you can't make being wasted something that's cool either. So what do we do about our drinking culture, apart from the policy side of things, David?
Well, you know, culture is something that we create ourselves. We are humans. We spin the web of meaning that we live in. And advertising is an intentional process of cultural change. Policies are a reflection of culture. So I don't make the distinction between policy and culture. We use policy to shape cultural practices all the time. That said, the general message from public health around alcohol is less is better. Whatever people are drinking, less is better. Whatever amount of alcohol is being made available, less is going to be better. We could be much healthier around this product than we are. I think the caller's right. There is a balance to be struck, and we're way over on that balance right now.
And briefly, as we wrap up, David, do you feel like people out there, policymakers in particular, share your sense of urgency about alcohol as a public health issue?
You know, the general public supports all these policies. The policymakers, year after year, do very little in the direction of what's going to make a difference. It's a big problem we're facing, and I hope that more public voices can get engaged. Policymakers need to hear people around this.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
David Jernigan is a professor in the Department of Health Law, Policy, and Management at Boston University's School of Public Health. He specializes in alcohol policy. We talked to him about America's drinking problems and some of the policy approaches to reduce alcohol consumption.